Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Hello, I'm Eric Anderson, and I'm happy to be joined again by Dr. Michael Denton for the final part of our conversation regarding his latest book, The Miracle of the Cell. Thanks for being back again, Mike.
Once again, a pleasure, Eric.
So we ended our prior discussion talking about energy use in the cell, specifically the millions upon millions of ATP molecules produced in the cell every single second. And we also talked about the electron transport chain and its vital role in pumping protons back into the mitochondria's inner membrane space so that the ATP-producing enzyme can do its work. You mentioned that this electron transport chain operates by harvesting energy from individual electrons that are passed from atom to atom, metallic ions, I believe, inside a specially structured space. So this discussion of energy is a great segue into the next topic I wanted to ask you about, the role of metals. First, for those of us who are a little rusty with our college chemistry, what do biochemists mean by metals?
Okay, Eric. Well, metals are a subclass of atoms in the periodic table of elements, which share a number of chemical and physical properties. If you look at a periodic table, you'll see that the atoms on the left-hand side and bottom of the table are metals. And these tend to be hard, lustrous, heavy solids, good conductors of electricity and heat, malleable, with high melting points. Metal atoms form a special type of bond with other metal atoms known as metallic bonds and ordinary ionic bonds with non-metals compounds such as we see in, say, for instance, metal oxides. Non-metals, on the other hand, are clustered into the top right-hand corner of the periodic table. Some are soft, lustrous solids, Others are gaseous at ambient temperatures, and they form, as previously discussed, directional covalent bonds with one another. They are less dense than metals and poor conductors of electricity and heat. Mm-hmm. The properties of about 10 different metals, mainly in the first quarter of the periodic table, are utilized in living systems. And each, as described in Miracle of the Cell, seem exquisitely fine-tuned to enable very specific biochemical functions in the cell.
Very good. Okay, that's helpful background. And in the book, you quote Robert Williams, who said, speaking of the important role of certain metals, "Biology without metal ions does not exist any more than biology exists without DNA or proteins." That's quite a statement and frankly pretty counterintuitive to most of us, given that we're constantly hearing about the importance of DNA. Yeah. Can you share with us a couple of metals from the periodic table that are particularly fit for life and their roles in the cell?
Sure. And I can cite more than two. There are several important roles which particular metals perform. Take iron, for example, which we've referred to in a few of the other podcasts in the past. We already discussed its role in the electron transport chain in a previous podcast and why the unique structure of its electron shells and other transition metal atoms make it particularly fit to form electron-conducting wires. As Robert Williams put it, man makes his wires from metals such as copper. Biology makes conductors from transition metal ions embedded in insulating material. And iron also is suited to activate oxygen to overcome what is technically termed oxygen's spin restriction. And it does this by donating one electron at a time to the oxygen molecule. And again, this is a talent shared only by other transition metal atoms. Hmm. Or take zinc. Generally classified again as a transition metal. A zinc atom plays a role in the active site of a K enzyme, carbonic anhydrase, which is involved in enabling the transport of carbon dioxide from the tissues to the lungs, a vital function in us air-breathing aerobes.
Right.
Or again, as mentioned when we talked last time about the membrane, sodium and potassium ions possess just the right characteristics needed for rapid transport of electric charge, enabling the rapid depolarization of the nerve cell membrane as the nerve signal moves along the axon. And one could go on. And Robert Williams was certainly not exaggerating when he proclaimed no biology without metals.
Okay, so help us out here. I just want to step back for a minute and take a look from a high level. In our conversations, we've been talking a lot about specific amazing atoms and molecules, and I kind of want to bring it all together now in one place. Specifically, we've got all these remarkable elements, but they have to be able to move and interact with each other. And one of the other books in your Privileged Species series, The Wonder of Water, really dives deeply into the fitness of water for our planetary environment, the critical role in plate tectonics, recycling of nutrients, and so on. And we know that we are made up of water in significant part. But what is it about water, as we think about the interactions of these atoms and molecules, that is uniquely fit for cells?
Well, there are, in fact, a vast number of properties of water that are essential for life. And as you mentioned, these are discussed in my prior book, The Wonder of Water. There are far too many to enumerate here. Just in terms of the cell, though, there are several special properties just worth mentioning briefly. Firstly, water is an excellent solvent. It's capable of holding in solution a vast inventory of small organic compounds. It has a very low viscosity, and this is fit to form the medium of the circulatory system, ensuring rapid diffusion of solutes from the capillaries to the tissue cells. At the same time, it is also fit to be pumped through the capillary bed.
Mm-hmm.
And its low viscosity also enables cell movement. It's easy to imagine the consequences if water had the viscosity of honey. All the constituents of the cell would be immobilized, and the walking and crawling ability of cells would be impossible, or at least massively constrained. The development of the embryo, for example, which is also critically dependent on the ability of cells to crawl and morph, would be also impossible.
Yeah, and this, this is something you mentioned in your book. We don't have time to get into it now, but this is a really remarkable thing that I think readers will enjoy reading about: embryo development and how these cells actually have to move in order to make that happen.
Yeah, absolutely. Cells couldn't move. They couldn't constrict the embryo. Moving is critical to the whole extraordinary, development of the embryos of multicellular organisms. But there's more, water's inability to dissolve hydrophobic compounds, we've talked about this earlier actually, like hydrocarbon chains, plays a vital role, as mentioned, in the formation of the cell membrane, as well as in the folding of proteins. Again, water is fit for proton conductance, which plays a vital role in proton pumping in the mitochondria. And what's happening at the moment in current research, the more the properties of water are examined, the more revealing new ways in which water plays crucial roles in cellular biochemistry keep coming to light. So water indeed has a vast number of properties which endow it with a special fitness to serve as the matrix of the cell. No other fluid comes close. Simply put, if water did not exist, it would have to be invented.
Yeah, it's really remarkable that it seems to just have the properties needed to the point that we almost take it for granted. I think a lot of lay people, when we think about it, we just say, well, that's the way it works, right?
Yeah.
We really dive in and pay attention to the details like you've done, which is great. So on a related note, in a prior conversation, we discussed the remarkable coincidence of the temperature range of many life-critical chemical reactions and the temperature range of liquid water on Earth, which just happened to coincide. And in addition, you talk about viscosity, diffusion, and other factors that seem to be just right for living organisms. I want to quote a couple of really beautiful sentences from the end of your chapter that underscore the sense of awe I think we should feel when we look closely at the evidence. So I'm quoting, "This is little short of a miracle. It is surely an awesome coincidence indicative of the profound fitness of water and by extension of nature for carbon-based life, that the optimum temperature range for the complex atomic and molecular manipulations essential for life is precisely the temperature range in which water, the ideal matrix in so many other ways, exists as a liquid at ambient conditions on Earth." And then finally, you go on to say, "In short, in the properties of water, nature appears to have had not only life in mind, but creatures like ourselves."
Yes, certainly, Eric. As I wrote, this is a truly awesome coincidence. Words fail. Certainly one of the most life-friendly coincidences in all of nature. Given the vast range of temperatures in the cosmos, that water should be a liquid in such an infinitely tiny fraction of that immense range is just so extraordinary. No other fact so highlights nature's supreme fitness for carbon-based life as it exists on Earth.
Yeah, just fantastic. Just fantastic. Yeah. I think we have time for just one more question. We've talked about so many remarkable atoms and molecules and cellular systems over these four conversations. I'd like to come full circle now and tie this all back to a personal experience you shared at the beginning of our first conversation. You talked about how working in intensive care medicine, you had a power, maybe we could even say almost eerie sense, that someone had been down this path before, that someone had already figured out how the very elements needed to be in order to enable life. As we wrap up, given the evidence that you've marshaled in your books, in particular this last book, The Miracle of the Cell, what is the significance of this line of evidence to the overall case for design?
Okay, well, for me, the major implication of the evidence presented in the book is that it provides what amounts to an independent, novel line of evidence which massively reinforces the traditional ID inference that the cell must have originated by design. Whether that design was built into nature or involved a special creative act. This core ID inference that such an immensely sophisticated, irreducibly complex system, containing among innumerable other adaptations, a coding system, the very hallmark of intelligent agency, could never have originated by mindless, undirected processes, as the mainstream Darwinists and origin of life researchers claim. This is defended in Behe's Darwin's Black Box, Steve's Signature in the Cell, Doug Axe's Undeniable, and many of the authors in The Mystery of Life's Origin, the updated version which just came out this year, and ages ago in my own Evolution, a Theory in Crisis.
Right.
So what Miracle shows is that that long before the first cell originated, many aspects of its design were already built in or prefigured or a blueprint, if you like, into the properties of about 20 atoms in the periodic table, each of which, as I've mentioned before, seems precisely fine-tuned for highly specific biochemical roles. And this is exactly, and this is extraordinary, this is exactly what one might expect if the intelligent design inference regarding the origin of the cell is right. If the origin of the cell was indeed by design, by whatever mechanism, its initial assembly occurred, then the existence of a set of components precisely fine-tuned long before the actual assembly of the cell to serve various vital, structural, and functional roles is powerful, supportive evidence that the ID inference is in fact correct. If God fashioned the atoms with such precision for life, would he really have left the assembly of the cell to chance? Seems unlikely.
So I guess what you're saying is while the inference to design based on an examination of the cell itself is very powerful, the fitness of the elements, the ingredients list, if you will, adds an entire additional layer of evidence for design?
Absolutely. For me, personally, any residual doubt I might have had that the cell is the result of design was blown away once I realized that a prior design for the cell already pre-existed in the natural order. The existence of the prior fitness for the cell seems to me to put the claim that the cell is the result of ID beyond any serious doubt. Finally, it's worth also pointing out that the cell is not the only major innovation in the history of life whose actualization was only possible because of an exquisite degree of prior fine-tuning in the natural order. A number of other examples are described in my other monographs of the Privileged Species series, Firemaker, Children of Light, and The Wonder of Water. The prior fitness for the cell is wonder enough, indeed, but it's only the beginning of a long series of blueprints in nature, which led ultimately to ourselves.
Yeah, that's a truly remarkable and fantastic additional line of evidence for design.
Yeah, and one final point, Eric. It's many years ago since my first encounter with the notion of fitness as a trainee pathologist in Sydney. Miracle of the Cell represents the outcome of many years of focus since then on this fascinating topic. And it's a great source of satisfaction to me personally that the evidence assembled in the book provides compelling evidence that at least in the case of the cell, to quote Fred Hoyle, someone must have monkeyed with the laws of physics. In effect, the book puts to bed any notion that life on Earth is a matter of chance.
Yeah, that's a great quote. A super intellect, I think, is the term Hoyle used in his discussion. And I think it's definitely appropriate to apply that to this context as well.
Yeah, sure. Yes.
Well, Mike, it's been an absolute pleasure over these last several conversations to learn more about this new book and the remarkable fine-tuning at work in the living cell, even down to the fitness of individual atoms. Thank you so much for sharing this with us. I'm confident our listeners will be eager to learn more as they read through this book themselves.
Thanks, Eric. It was a pleasure talking to you. Great to do these podcasts.
This has been a conversation with Dr. Michael Denton, author of the newly released book, The Miracle of the Cell. I can't recommend this book enough and definitely encourage our listeners to pick up a copy of the book to learn more about the incredible cell and the uncanny fitness of the very elements that enable and even point to our existence. You can find The Miracle of the Cell in paperback or ebook format at online retailers like Amazon and Barnes & Noble. Thank you for listening. For ID the Future, I'm Eric Anderson.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.